When the Protestant Reformation, the story of the Protestant Reformation is told, it ordinarily follows the lines of its chief spiritual leaders, Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, Knox, and many others, all of whom are men, all of whom are godly, eminently godly, and gifted men. But there's another part of the story that needs telling, the heartwarming and inspiring account of the courage and commitment, the piety and the praise, the fearless faith of the women of the Reformation. And the list of these women is long indeed. It includes martyrs and magistrates, those married to reformers and others. And it includes obvious names like Lady Jane Grey and Jean d'Albret, the Queen of Navarre, as well as the wives of the reformers, including Luther's Kate, whom he referred to as Kate, my rib, and Calvin's Idalette, and others. But in thinking especially of the wives of the reformers, we're reminded, are we not, of the old adage that behind every great man is found a great woman. But how often could it be said that behind three or four great men is found the same great woman? Behind three or four great men is found the same woman. Well, that brings us to the subject of our biographical address today, a woman whom I consider as one of the gems, albeit hidden gems, but one of the premier gems of the Reformation, Vibrandis Rosenblatt. I should say, in the spirit of full disclosure, my esteem for Vibrandis Rosenblatt is so great, and this is true. When my wife was pregnant with our daughter 15 years ago, I employed all of my persuasive powers in attempting to bring my wife to agree to naming our daughter Vibrandis Rosenblatt. As those of you who know my daughter can testify, I proved unsuccessful in that endeavor. We settled instead for the shared name of the two Wigden martyrs, coupled with the geographical center of the Reformation, which was good enough. My wife, of course, loves Vibrandis Rosenblatt and her story, but her name was a bit too much. So now I'm holding out for a granddaughter, or perhaps someone here will be inspired. As I told my wife, you can call her Rose, and that's not too bad. So Vibrandis Rosenblatt was married to four successive husbands, three of whom were very, very significant Protestant reformers. She's been dubbed by some as the bride of the Reformation, or Reformation Frau, to use the German. She was of great significance because of that, and for many other reasons, as you'll soon see. She was the mother herself of 11 children, and she gathered under her care many more, as we'll be discussing. Her husbands don't enjoy the kind of name recognition like the household names of Luther and Calvin. But as those who have studied church history will know, and those especially who are students of historical theology can affirm, these men were in fact heavyweights. These were some major leaders laboring shoulder to shoulder with some of the more familiar names. Her first husband was Ludwig Keller. He's the one that's least known. And then after him, three gigantic reformers, Oecolampadius, followed by Capito, and then lastly Martin Bucer. And Bucer's name is probably the most familiar to those who may know these names. Some of his works are still in print today. I should also note that each of these, Oecolampadius, then Capito, then Bucer, all inherited the previous husband's libraries. So this is, for a minister, this is especially interesting to me. Her life was placed in the crossroads of the Swiss Reformation. and Southern German, or the Reformed wing of the Reformation in Southern Germany. So this is true in terms of people as well as places. Geographically, she was centered in Basel and Strasbourg, two of the chief cities, along with Zurich in the Swiss Reformation. And then she was taken, as you'll see in a moment, also to Cambridge, England, the center of the English Reformation. But she was also in the crossroads of significant figures, had close contact with Zwingli and Calvin and Bullinger and Farel and Peter Martyr, Vermigli, and even people like the Spaniard heretic Michael Servetus was found in her home and at her table, the one who was put to death under Calvin and under Calvin's Geneva. She was closely associated with Johann Sturm, the great Reformation educationist in Strasbourg, and Grinaeus, and the names go on and on and on. So that if you were to draw lines, if you will, in terms of geographical locations and draw lines in terms of significant Reformation figures, all of these lines would intersect in this one woman. Absolutely astounding. Her story, I think, is amazing. The Brandis means, apparently, battle sword. Two words brought together, battle sword. And she ended up proving to be very much a great force in the cause of the Protestant Reformation. She grew up in Basel. This is Switzerland, children, Basel, Switzerland. She also ended up going full circle, returning to Basel at the end of her life and dying there as a plague of the victim. She was thus a German-speaking Swiss, apparently very gifted, not only spiritually but intellectually. She was able to converse skillfully in Latin. Oecleampadius, her second husband, wrote and recorded that she knew her theology very well. She ran in university-educated circles. And being in Basel, of course, is on the Rhine. It's right near where France and Germany and Switzerland all come together. It was then a hub of both culture and commerce and became one of the chief hubs of the Protestant Reformation. There were several intellectuals which came from that area, including the famous Erasmus. And I'll just note here, he's known for several things, including the production of the first Greek text. And both Oecleampadius and Capito served as assistants to him in the production of that Greek New Testament. She was originally living with her widowed mother in Basel. She married at age 20 Ludwig Keller. That marriage, while by all accounts was vibrant in terms of spirituality, only lasted 2 years. Her husband died, and then she was widowed. She remained in Basel with her mother. Oecleampadius, Johannes Oecleampadius, was living at the time in Basel. His name, as two Greek words put together, means house lamp, and he proved to be a spiritual light for many in his own generation. A man of remarkable gifts as a linguist, versed in Hebrew, and few were, a very theologically erudite, gifted in terms of ecclesiastical antiquity, and so on. He produced commentaries on texts of Scripture, which ended up being the standard and very influential for Reformed preachers and other scholars. He was a former priest, and so he had been a bachelor until 45, when at age 45 he was wed to Vibrandis. He ended up being destined to be a spiritual leader amidst the Swiss Reformation. He had spent some time in Augsburg, Germany, the city that I was born in. Others that had gone there as well, but his main base was in Basel. It's interesting that Erasmus, who became suspicious of the reformers, quipped when Oecleampadius married Vibrandis that Oecleampadius had married an attractive girl as a Latin penance. So he was making fun of him. Her husband, however, said that he married her because she had several years' experience in bearing the cross. And he went on, he wrote to Capito 1 year after they were married and said, "My wife is what I always wanted. She is not contentious, garrulous, or a gadabout, but looks after the household. He also wrote to Farrell and said she is well versed in the knowledge of Christ and she oversees the household with prudence. I couldn't wish for better. And so he asks Farrell in that letter, pray the Lord to give us a long and happy marriage. But that was not to be. The marriage only lasted 4 years. With the Lord's blessing, they had 3 children. The first was a son born to them there in Basel. Eusebius, who was obviously named after the church father, he died later on in Strasbourg at age 13 as a victim of the plague. The second child was Aletheia, which means truth, a girl's name. She went on to marry Christopher Sell, who was a leading voice and leader in Strasbourg and a preacher there and a colleague of Bucer. And the third child was Irene. So Aletheia ended up being a significant figure herself. In fact, everything we know about her subsequent to her marriage is that she carried with her the spirit of her mother, virtuous, vibrant, and very exercised in spirituality. In 1529, Oecolampadius, along with others, destroyed all of the images in Basel and had reformed the observance of the Lord's Supper. Calvin held Oecolampadius' work in the highest possible esteem. You'll remember his first edition of the Institutes were written there in Basel. And Oecolampadius himself ended up being an assistant under Zwingli, the probably best known Swiss reformer. At this stage, you can begin to appreciate not only the theological circle that's forming in the Swiss Reformation, but also the social circle that is attached to that as well. Because there was correspondence between Vibrandus, now Oecolampadius, married to Oecolampadius, there's correspondence between her and Agnes Capito, Capito's wife, and Elizabeth Bucer, who ended up becoming one of her best friends, the wife of Bucer in Strasbourg, as well as Anna Zwingli in Zurich. In October 1531, Zwingli himself died at the Battle of Kappel, and Oecolampadius died in the following month, November of that year. Bucer said, when he died, quote, we have no greater theologian than him, than Oecolampadius. And his whole concern was the formation of a pure church. Vibrandus remained for the time in Basel. But interestingly, this brings us to her third husband, Wolfgang Capito. It was around the same time that Oecolampadius died that his fellow reformer and friend in Strasbourg, Capito, lost his wife. And so Martin Bucer, I hope you're recognizing the connection of all of these names, ends up playing matchmaker to bring Capito, the widower, together with Vibrandus, the widow. He himself is going to eventually marry her in time to come. So this close friend brings these two together. Consequently, she moves to Strasbourg, which, if you don't know much about Reformation history, is one of the number one hotbeds in the whole of Europe in terms of Reformation activity. And so she moves there. Strasbourg is in the crossfire of France and Germany, as well as the crossfire of the Reformed and the Lutherans. So within southern Germany, there was tremendous and very interesting history of the clash between the Reformed and the Lutherans, and it was being fought out chiefly in Strasbourg. Capito was a totally different person. Again, an able, an excellent scholar who wrote a number of significant works which continue to be referenced as some of his stuff is being translated into English and published now. Personality-wise, he was impractical, probably less stable than Oecolampadius, tended toward depression and had other like struggles. And so she's now married to Capito in very different circumstances, seeking to serve and assist her husband there. Well, in 1541, the plague came through Strasbourg, and 3,200 people died. Let me remind you, for those who don't know your history very well, the plague, the Black Death, as it's referred to, was of such significance that at one point it wiped out somewhere between 30% and 50% of Europe. Now, when we think of the plague, we all tend to think of the 14th century. And that's when it kind of was at its zenith in terms of carrying away so many in its death toll. But there was a recurrence of the plague decade after decade for a few centuries, extending into the 18th century. And so those of you who especially have read a lot of the Puritans, you'll remember the Great Plague of London in 1665 and in 1666. The Puritans going into the city and laboring amidst all of the devastation of the plague. That's the same plague that was going through Strasbourg over a century before. It was characterized by things like fever and trembling and weakness and sweating, vomiting. The chief thing was that these black tumors would form under the armpits and in the groin, sometimes as small as a golf ball, sometimes as big as a softball. They would ooze with pus and blood. But two-thirds of the people that contracted the disease were dead in 3 days. Many of them dead within 24 hours or within 48 hours. In this scourge in 1541, Martin Bucer lost 4 of his 5 children to the plague. The plague also went on to kill. Remember, Brandis is living with Capito in Strasbourg at this time. It went on to kill Eusebius, Oecolampadius, her son from the previous marriage, as well as 2 of the children of Capito, and then Capito himself, all taken away. So now we find Vibrandus widowed for the 3rd time. At the same time, in the same plague that Capito died, Martin Bucer's wife Elizabeth also died. So Martin Bucer's wife Elizabeth is Vibrandus's probably best friend. They live now in the same city and were joined in the same Reformation cause, their 2 husbands being chief leaders. And so there Elizabeth is on her deathbed. She's dying of this horrific disease. And she calls her husband to her bedside. And her parting wish is that he would marry her best friend, Vibrandus. And then she calls in Vibrandus as well to her deathbed and communicates the same dying wish to Vibrandus, asking that she would take her husband to be her own husband. I think Bucer said something like, "We could not answer at all except with tears at the time." But that wish ended up being fulfilled in due course. Bucer went on to say, having married Vibrandus, he said, "I can only hope to be as kind to my new wife as she to me." Calvin had just spent his stint in Strasbourg just prior to this. So you'll remember Calvin's in Geneva. He goes, there's all the big debacle. He leaves and goes to Strasbourg for 3 years. And then he leaves Strasbourg just as the plague is coming, and all of this happens, and Vibrandus is wed to Bucer. Calvin was extremely influenced by Martin Bucer. Bucer was probably the chief preacher in terms of expository preaching of the whole Reformation. Calvin was influenced by that. He was influenced by the worship reform that Bucer had implemented in Strasbourg, including his extensive use of the Psalter, so that as Calvin prepared to go back to Geneva, it was on the criteria that a French metrical version of the Psalms would be employed exclusively within the worship of Geneva, which was in fact enacted, as most of you will know. Bucer was again a different personality, a lover of peace. He was the chief unifier of the Protestant Reformation. He was eccentric in his own way. His handwriting was illegible and chaotic. One woman learned Latin so that she could correspond with Bucer, only to discover she couldn't read what he wrote to her. The household now has become very interesting because of all of those that are comprising it. You have 2 children from Bucer's first marriage. You have the children from Vibrandus's previous marriages, including 2 from Oecolampadius and 2 from Capito. There's also the stepson of Bucer's first marriage. She brings her widowed mother along with her as well, and they have a host of others. that are either near relation or friends attached to the household at various times. In addition, they would adopt and bring in needy children, students for the ministry. Theological students were constantly staying with them. They took in refugees who had fled from areas of persecution. You have all sorts of people, the revolving doors, because of their influence coming through. People like Peter Martyr Vermigli, the man who came from Italy, one of the great reformers whose works have been put back into English again recently. He writes, speaks with the most glowing terms of the household at this particular time. The household also includes Bucer's son, Nathaniel, who is mentally and physically handicapped. And the correspondence between Bucer and him is interesting, a story all its own. She continues to care for him after the death of Bucer. Well, there they are in Strasbourg. There's this horrific difficulty happening. The Romanists, the Papists are bringing great, ferocious assaults down upon the heads of those in Strasbourg. Eventually, the Augsburg interim is reached, which requires the imposition of Romanist worship on those in Strasbourg and requires that men like Bucer be exiled. Well, that happens at about the same time that Archbishop Cranmer in England was gathering a who's who to himself in England, a synodus of the leading Reformation intellectuals. So Peter Martyr, Vermigli was brought, people like John Alasco, the Polish reformer, Martin Bucer, along with his colleague in Strasbourg, Fagius. There were others, even Ochino, who ended up apostatizing later. He's gathering together a who's who there in England. Edward VI, that remarkable magistrate, whom if you haven't read of, you would do well to read of, was reigning at the time. Cranmer is seeking to advance the English Reformation. Knox goes through and spends time there. John Hooper is working on Reformation at the same time in England. So Bucer takes this invitation and goes to Cambridge and is established as a theologian there. To be honest, he hates the place. The climate of Britain, the food of Britain, the culture of Britain never agreed with him. He can't stand the food that they serve. He longed for German fare. The fireplaces that were common were too drafty and made him sick. He wanted a German stove, which in fact he was given money to buy and import to England to add to his household. And he suffered with some pretty significant chronic illness as a result of this. But Brandis was married to him for 9 years, including this period. They had no children, the two of them, Bucer and Verbrandis, together, though, as I said, the household was brimming with others. Bucer had commented that his wife was perfect in every respect, except that she did not rebuke him as much as Elizabeth had, and he felt that he needed stronger words spoken to him at times. So you get the sense that she is a meek and quiet spirit and of a vibrant support to her husband. That's not to say she was weak, because she's sent back to Strasbourg while he has to remain laboring in England to fetch the family. And just the voyage, the trip, all of the threats and risks and problems and everything else that was associated with that was enough. But she gets back to Strasbourg and she just barely escapes being summoned by a Catholic official who's trying to confiscate all of her family, all of Bucer's property. She's under the care of Christopher Sell, her son-in-law, who's a godly Reformed preacher and leader in Strasbourg at the time. He doesn't tell her. And she says afterward, "It's a good thing you didn't tell me, because I might have had something hot to say to these papists." And so there's obviously some strength there as well. That you see exhibited in her. In order to escape the city, they wait until the whole city is celebrating the Mass, and she flees and takes her people back with her to Cambridge. 1551, 9 years after being married to Martin Bucer, he too dies there in Cambridge. And so she returns with her family to Strasbourg briefly, and then ultimately returns to Basel, where she lives the remaining 10 years of her life, dying in 1564. Like Luther's Kate, after Luther's death, she would sign her letters, a solitary widow. And Kate, Luther's wife, said that she was clinging to Christ like a burr to a dress. And that could be said equally of Vibrandus Bucer at this point. She, too, dies of the plague in another recurrence that strikes Basil in 1564. So I'm giving you really a very brief sketch of her life. Let me focus on some lessons that we can draw from this remarkable woman. The first thing, and this is more of an aside, is that the Christian faith gives a unique importance to women. The Christian faith gives a unique importance to women. Biblical Christianity dignifies, whereas every unbelieving form of religion degrades the female race. So you think of the Old Testament. God places up front for all of us to see, set on display, people like Sarah and people like Ruth and people like Esther. Remarkably, in the New Testament, women are given a significant place in the ministry of the Lord Jesus. They are the first witnesses to his resurrection. And we could multiply other instances. The same can be said in the history of the church. In our own day, we have the resurgence of feminism, that pernicious, vile philosophy. It degrades women. The problem with feminism is not that it gives too high of a place to women. That's not the problem. It's the problem is that it gives the wrong place to women. And by giving them the wrong place, it is too low of a place because it's not God's place. Trying to give what belongs to men to women is to degrade, not to dignify them. You think of taking, you know, one of these bulky, beefy chains that you hook to the back of your tractor to pull a stump out of the ground with, you know. If you were to instead gather a very elegant number of golden necklaces and tie them together and put that on the back of your tractor to pull the stump out, you would say, well, what are you doing? You're degrading this beautiful piece of jewelry. And it's the same. So here we are. We're faced with the resurgence of feminism. Some are reacting to feminism, even within the church, by degrading women, by taking an unbiblical view of women, by trying to put them in their place in all of the wrong ways, to put women down and to elevate men in inappropriate ways. But recognize that in so doing, those people are actually joining the feminists rather than refuting them. What we need is to stick to the book and to follow precisely what God himself has given. And he gives different positions and places, different statuses and different responsibilities to different people. There's a variety, and it works together in harmony if we follow the Lord's way. And so here we have the Lord granting to the church what amounts to a chief gem at the time of the Protestant Reformation. Number two, notice that she did not enjoy a carefree, perfect family pursuing the equivalent of the American dream. What a bunch of obnoxious nonsense. They lived reality. Life was not about self-satisfaction. It wasn't about comfort, about having all the right things and all of free of all the right stresses and so on. Life was viewed, as Scripture defines it, as service of the great king, not the pursuit of self-gratification, but the pursuit of service of the great king and seeking first the kingdom and his righteousness. In other words, life is about giving, about spending and being spent, giving ourselves to others rather than getting for ourselves. And so here she is, devoted happily and delightfully in secret service. She saw the place that God gave her and she embraced it. And the Bible says that the greatest in the kingdom are those who are chief servants. And so by God's definition, she is one of the greatest in the kingdom and receives thus all of the rewards that are associated with that. You think of this woman caring for the dying, caring for the sick, taking in refugees, working herself to the bone, you know, caring for extended family, travelers that are coming in. There's upheaval, there's all of the insecurities, there's having to move, there's all the pressure of enormous responsibilities that her husbands were having to shoulder. We see her having to interact with one of her children, at least, was rebellious, a rebellious son. You see her bearing that sorrow, writing passionate letters to her son, rebuking him and calling him to account and speaking to him about the privileges given to him that he's rejecting and so on, and yet having to bear some of the heartbreak that is associated with that. That's the Christian life, folks. You know, we can take this perfect family pursuing the American dream business and recognize that it is unbiblical, humanistic nonsense. It's not the pattern, the apostolic. It's not what we find in any of the saints in the Old Testament, any of the saints in the New Testament, or the best and brightest in the history of the world. Thirdly, we see her perseverance in tragedy and in suffering. She begins by losing her father and caring for her widowed mother. Then she herself is widowed, not once, twice, three times, but is widowed herself four times. To bury a spouse is enough to destroy anyone. And yet she buries four of them. In addition, she conceives and then carries for 9 months and nurses and then raises up and pours out her affection and love upon children whom she buries one after another, after another, after another. And what does she do? She comes under submitting to the Lord, bringing herself, coalescing to His sovereign will and providence, bearing these things with faith and with a measure of dependence upon the Lord. They experienced tight finances at various points. They were objects of overt religious persecution. It was a life of struggle. It was a life that was exceedingly uncomfortable. And yet she conducted herself with grace and with sincere love for Christ and His cause. And to see her godly response in the midst of that suffering, it carried a profound influence on her children. And this is the test, I think. Suffering is non-negotiable for the Christian. Some respond with bitterness and all sorts of invectives and an ungodly spirit. It's transferred. It destroys the children. Then there are those who seek to bear it up with genuine godliness before the Lord. And there is a profound influence. It's not the suffering that makes the difference. It's the way in which one walks with the Lord before and with the children. She ended up being a matriarch. Rather than cultivating bitterness in her or in her children, it was quite the opposite. And so it's an example of perseverance in the midst of tragedy after tragedy and acute suffering. Fourthly, we see a diverse family, right? She has her own children. She has the adopted children of her husbands from their previous marriages. She has extended family. At one point, one of her husband's fathers living with her widowed mother living with her, nieces and nephews and others, friends, refugees, people that are inhabiting her house. And yet she had the ability to make everybody feel as if they belonged, loving them indiscriminately as her own. I mean, you have a child from Keller who lives on, her husband. Children from Oakley and Pottius and Vibrandus. Capito and his previous marriage. Capito and Vibrandus, Bootser and Vibrandus, and so on. And you know what's interesting to me? As I'm studying her life, you look at the heritage of her children and grandchildren. They named their daughters after her. Now, what's interesting to me is that the children of Kapido and the children of Butzer from previous marriages, not her own biological children, were naming their children and grandchildren after this matriarch, after this vibrant, godly woman who had been such a spiritual and had such a profound influence on them. She had the ability to spiritually invest in the posterity of others because she was chiefly not concerned with herself. She was chiefly concerned with the cause of Christ, His glory, His kingdom, His people. And let me just say, the application of this applies outside of the household. So what we see happening with Vibrandis in the midst of her household was also displayed outside of her household. For us, it can be displayed outside of our household. It thrills my heart as a minister when I have watched those in our congregation who have made a self-conscious and deliberate, a studied effort to seek to bring spiritual blessing and influence to the collective covenant children within our congregation. That is absolutely wonderful. To not just be living in our own little world, rah, 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 you know, we're a family-centered world. We're not. We're a Christ-centered, kingdom-centered world. And therefore, we have an obligation to all the covenant children within the household of faith. And we have the privilege of seeking to deliberately and self-consciously invest spiritually in the posterity of others. Fifthly, we see she had four husbands, all of whom had very diverse personalities, different backgrounds, different gifts, and yet every last one of them equally prized her as a phenomenal helpmeet. They prized her greatly as a phenomenal helpmeet. This says something about her, the strength of her godly character, adapting to very different men, and being able to serve and care for and meet the needs of these men in their varying capacities. They all sung her praises to the nth degree. She would, on one hand, stand up with all the backbone you can muster against evil, herself exercise spiritually in her piety as well as in her theological commitments. She brought about with her own strength, in her own strength and dependence upon the Lord, the advance of the Protestant Reformation, serving other preachers, students, refugees, you name it, not to mention upholding the hands of her husbands who were leading the cause. And yet she was able to do all of this without an edgy, contentious spirit, a meekness, a tenderness that was imparted to both her husbands and her children. Butzer would call her repeatedly his beloved, his pious, his faithful bride. And so we are to recognize here, this is, how many of you knew about Vibrandis Rosenblatt prior to this? Well, some of you may have heard me mention her name before. There's probably few, if any of you, who have actually studied her life. And the fact is that history has not pushed her to the front. But biblically, she was conducting herself in the main things. She was chiefly and passionately concerned not with her immediate circumstances and all that is associated with that. She was chiefly and passionately concerned with the advance of Christ's kingdom, the reformation of the church in the world, and especially throughout Europe. And I'm here to tell you, the Lord owned those labors. As secret as they were, He richly blessed them, far beyond what we can probably capture even in our study of her life, and will only be revealed on the last day when all of the glory and honor and praise will be given to the great King Himself as we cast our crowns to His or at His feet. May the Lord strengthen us as we seek to profit and following her as she followed Christ.